Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, historian David Greenberg assesses Ann Beattie's unusual new novel about Pat Nixon.
It's really a meditation, a rumination, trying to use this enigmatic figure of Pat to somehow get at something larger about politics, about women, perhaps about the First Lady's role.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Alexander Starr takes an anthropological view of Afghanistan.
A lot of what we've done in the past, since Americans arrived in Afghanistan in 2001, hasn't worked. And it often hasn't worked because not enough was known about local circumstances, local communities.
And Gregory Coles has bestseller news. Well, if Richard Nixon was the strangest of all presidents, his wife Pat Nixon may have been the most enigmatic of first ladies. And a major American author, Ann Beattie, famous for her short stories and novels, has taken a crack at penetrating the mask of Pat Nixon. Her book is called Mrs. Nixon, A Novelist Imagines a Life. It's reviewed for us by distinguished historian of Richard Nixon's career, David Greenberg, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, David.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
All right. So what is Ann Beattie trying to do here? Is she really trying to give us the actual Pat Nixon?
There's actually a lot less biography in this book than you might expect. It's really a meditation, a rumination, trying to use this enigmatic figure of Pat to somehow get at something larger about politics, about women, perhaps about the First Lady's role. But ultimately, it's about writing. I mean, where Beattie comes down in the end is onto her own process of trying to figure out what she's doing in this book.
Now, David, Ann Beattie is distinguished American fiction writer, and people of a certain age, and I'm afraid I'm in that group, will remember how she kind of revolutionized the short story in the 1970s and 80s, partly by bringing, in the first major sustained way, an entire generation to print, the kind of the burned out 60s cases who are making their way in this America. Is there some kind of affinity between her and Richard Nixon's wife? Where does the connection come?
Well, I think certainly the same impulses that have driven her to write about this generation, these types in her fiction, animates this project as well, that you can see the same Ann Beattie at work. It's psychological, it's probing, it's interior. At the same time, Pat represents something that the baby boomer generation is very much rebelling against, right? I mean, she's sort of the antithesis of the feminist, of the women's liber. The feminists used to protest her. They called her Plastic Pat. It was all a bit unfair, given that Pat was really never avowedly an enemy of theirs. She was just that sort of by happenstance of her position.
Well, you raise an interesting question here. Does Ann Beattie in some way identify with Pat Nixon?
She almost begins with the opposite suggestion, that she's drawn to Pat because she's so unlike her. And there are intimations that there's something with her mother going on, that she, in one passage, kind of comments on the similarities between her mother and Pat Nixon and imagines a meeting between her mother and Pat in a shoe store. So there's something psychological going on, I think, behind this attraction, because I think Pat Nixon wouldn't ordinarily be sort of the most fascinating, the most compelling, the most engrossing subject for a novelist. You might just think she's a little too flat on the page to warrant that kind of artistic attention.
Now, you wrote an important prize-winning book called Nixon's Shadow, and it's really about the image of Nixon, Richard Nixon, in our culture. And so you're sympathetic to this idea that you look at a real-life person and his or her mythic dimension. You also mention in the review that some really major novelists and fiction writers, Don DeLillo, Donald Barthelme, Norman Mailer, we can think of others, Robert Coover, have looked at political figures or American politics, really tried to dig deep to find that secret about the American unconscious life. So let me ask you, how much work has Ann Beattie done? Now you can assess her as a historian. How hard has she worked on this book?
Right. Well, it's a little peculiar. She opens by claiming, I've done a lot of research for this book. To me, it seems she really hasn't. Now, Pat's a hard subject to research because she didn't leave behind a whole lot in terms of papers, no memoir. There's a biography by her daughter. So
she also didn't love interviews and the public side of
exactly. Right. Yeah, she was sort of withdrawn as first lady. You know, had no wish to kind of be out there in any modern sense whatsoever. She was the long-suffering wife, very much. Didn't like politics. Period. The sources that Beattie does turn to are sort of these out of date kind of early 70s sources. You know, Joe McGinnis's Selling of the President, which is, you know, a fine book but very dated today. Same with Jonathan Schell's Time of Illusion, which was basically stuff he wrote for The New Yorker in the 70s. And it all kind of drips with this sort of early 70s sort of liberal contempt for Nixon that hasn't really been processed or reflected upon with the passage of time or any sense of perspective. So to use these couple of books as your crutch, even for Nixon, but especially for Pat, just seemed to me to be trapping herself in a very limited perspective.
And what about just the narrative? It's a very unusual book, as you say. It ends up being about the writing process. Is this a book you enjoyed reading?
Yeah, I struggled with it. You know, I felt that at times, you know, I was hoping to get to some greater insights about Pat. But what I found was most interesting was when she did digress. And she says, you know, in a biography, you're not supposed to digress. But then she embraces digression. And what was interesting to me, you know, this author of these very taut, well-crafted, finely sculpted short stories here embraces something that at one point she calls metafiction, where she's kind of openly commenting on what she's doing. She's musing about the writing process. And a lot of these jags are kind of interesting. But ultimately, I don't think they get us too much closer to understanding Pat Nixon or the First Lady or politics.
Thank you, David.
My pleasure, Sam.
That's David Greenberg, who reviews Mrs. Nixon, A Novelist Imagines a Life by Ann Beattie in this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So, the National Book Awards, were you there?
I was there. This is the annual event, sort of the Oscars of the literary world. And in the days and weeks leading up to the National Book Awards, there's always a lot of sniping about who's on the finalist list, especially for fiction. And this year was no different. The list of fiction finalists were, for the most part, rather obscure, not only the authors, but the publishers. There was, you know, tiny publishers, one from North Carolina, smaller publishers based in New York, with one exception, and that was Taya Obrett for her book, The Tiger's Wife, published by Random House.
Which was a very big deal, reviewed on our cover and a bestseller and all the rest. So who won? Tell us.
Jessamyn Ward was the winner for fiction for her book, Salvage the Bones, which was a story set in a fictional Gulf Coast town in Mississippi as a hurricane is bearing down on the town. And it's a story told by a 15-year-old pregnant girl. Now, Jessamyn Ward is an Alabama native. She was in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina hit. So she based much of this book on those experiences.
Who published it?
The publisher was Bloomsbury USA, which is a division of Bloomsbury based in London. And Jessamyn Ward is a former writer in residence at the University of Mississippi. And this is her second novel.
Good for her. What about the other categories?
In the nonfiction category, Stephen Greenblatt won for his book, The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. And the judges praised this book as a rumination on the pleasure of knowledge and on the agony of its loss.
Which may sound kind of highfalutin and portentous, but really it's quite a wonderful narrative about the rediscovery of Lucretius's poem on the nature of things. And Greenblatt, Mr. Greenblatt, Professor Greenblatt, came in and did a podcast. And I'll tell you, when he talks about these very remote subjects, this story is actually set during the Renaissance really brings it to life, and he did in his book too. Good for him.
And he spoke about that in his acceptance speech. He said that his book is about the power of books to cross boundaries, to speak to you across time and distance, and his book is about what the magic of the written word is. So that was acknowledged last night. There were also winners in poetry. Nikki Finney won for her fourth collection, which is called Head Off and Split, published by Northwestern University Press. And the prize for young people's literature went to Thana Lai for Inside Out and Back Again. And that was published by Harper.
Now, Julie, I remember when the National Book Awards ceremony was held actually quite close to the Times building at a Marriott Hotel in Times Square. Where was it held this
year?
The
lovely Marriott Hotel. There was actually a joke at the awards about the Marriott Hotel. David Steinberger, who is the publisher of Perseus Books and also runs the National Book Awards, spoke last night about the slightly less glamorous days when the ceremony was held in the Marriott in Midtown Manhattan. Last night, as it was held last year, it was held at Cipriani Wall Street, which is a very nice space, kind of a cavernous, huge ballroom, very long cocktail hour and very fancy black tie event. Each table cost $12,000. So there were a lot of publishers there who said that they had kind of scraped together all of the money that they could so that they could be there to see their finalists acknowledged and some winners as well. There were also a couple of parallel parties going on for the younger, less established members of the publishing industry. They had there was a party held by the Association of American Publishers called the National Book Awards House Party, and that seemed to be attended by a lot of younger publicists, editors, and such.
But Julie, here we have these publishers in black tie occupying Wall Street?
It was uncomfortably close, actually, which was referred to a couple of times throughout the awards. Zuccotti Park was only 4 blocks away from Cipriani on Wall Street, and Anne Lauterbach, the poet, when she got on stage to introduce the great poet John Ashbery, who won the award for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters, Anne Lauterbach said that she thought she should point out, since no one else had, that they were occupying Wall Street.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
The longer the Afghanistan war grinds on, the less we seem to understand about the people and the landscape and the culture. Our senior editor, Alexander Starr, has been reading some books on the subject and has written an essay for us. It's called Applied Anthropology, and Alex is here to talk about it. Welcome, Alex.
Hello, Sam.
All right. So what you looked at are actual works of anthropology. How does that help? What do these books do?
Well, I think at this point in the war, there's a pretty wide consensus that a lot of what we've done in the past since Americans arrived in Afghanistan in 2001 hasn't worked. And it often hasn't worked because not enough was known about local circumstances, local communities. There was an idea that this very attractive, well-dressed man, Hamid Karzai, could be put in power, and simply because he belonged to the Pashtun ethnic group, whereas many of the other power brokers in Afghanistan were not Pashtuns, this would create a balance and would create sufficient harmony to create a state and end a war.
That didn't work.
Clearly has not happened. And the complexities of the local conditions under which the Taliban have been able to revive themselves require analysis.
So, Alex, you looked closely at 3 books. Is that right?
Yes.
Let's go through them. What's the first one? Bizarre Politics, Power and Pottery in an Afghan Market Town, by Noah Coburn. What's he doing here?
Well, this is the first work of actual anthropology to be published since the Americans arrived in 2001. And it is simply the record of a guy who was a graduate student at Boston University moved to a village north of Kabul called Istalif and did what anthropologists did, participant observation, living in a town, getting to know people, observing the customs, the folkways, creating as little difference and distance between himself and the villagers as possible as he does so.
What did he find?
He found a place that was essentially full of paradoxes. It's a peaceful community, a place where it's relatively prosperous. Pottery is made there that is fashionable and popular, can be bought in stores in Kabul. People in Kabul go to this place for picnics and holidays. It's a beautiful town. And it's also inhabited mainly by ethnic Tajiks who are not likely to be well disposed to the Taliban at all. At the same time, it's a place that's riven by conflict and enmity and distrust. And there's a very complicated balance between the conflict and the sort of experience of distrust and
Are these tribal differences? Are they old family differences? Are they social conflicts of the kind we might find here in the United States?
They're certainly not tribal differences, although people often speak glibly about tribes as the sort of bedrock of Afghan society. The Tajiks in Afghanistan really are not organized into anything you would call tribes at all. There are differences. Many of them involve rivalries left over from the days of the anti-Soviet jihad between different commanders and people who worked for them. Much of the conflict simply involves different neighborhoods or people in different professions who are jostling against each other in different ways and stand to benefit from roads being built or development money being handed down in differential degrees. And, you know, often are wary of change because something that changes might help one person more than another and therefore threaten the fragile equilibrium the town has.
Now, Alex, those sound like conflicts you might find in any town, in any country on the map. Is there something particularly fraught and intense about these conflicts? Are they harder to resolve than they might be, say, in suburban Westchester where I live?
Well, they're not impossible to resolve because in many ways, at least for now, some kind of stability has emerged. The main difference is you do not really have functioning levels of government above the village that are able to intervene in those conflicts in a way that are recognized and trusted by the people who live there. And the brunt of Coburn's book is to argue that expecting, for instance, legal systems that are being constructed in Kabul to apply in a village like this, it's just probably not going to work. People resent outsiders. They want to settle their own problems according to the manner they're accustomed to, even if that sometimes doesn't look so pretty from the point of view of Western legal norms and so forth. This is something we have to live with. And you know, this is the kind of thing one might expect anthropologists to say. After World War II, Ruth Benedict wrote a book called The Chrysanthemum and the Sword about Japan, and she said that, you know, essentially the project of, you know, now is not to make the world safe for democracy, but as she put it, to make the world safe for difference. For a long time, anthropologists in that tradition have stressed the sort of intractable complexity of local conditions and how immune they are to being reformed and changed from outside or from above, and have often had a lot of sympathy for those traditions. And to some extent anyway, this book belongs in that lineage of anthropological thought.
Okay, let's look at the next one. It's called Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. It's by Thomas Barfield. Just the title sounds very ambitious and broad.
Yeah, this is a very extensive work. There is another anthropologist named Louis Dupree who wrote a somewhat similar book decades ago that was sort of a standard work, and I think this book is meant to in some ways, you know, replace that and be more up to date. Barfield is an anthropologist who's done field work in Afghanistan, wrote a book on indigenous domestic architecture in parts of the country. But the focus of this book, like the Coburn, is really on political power, the relationship between the center of the country and the periphery and so forth. And he tells, you know, a very complicated and rich story that is full of lessons, really. Something that interested me was, you know, it's been pointed out that when Western military presence in Afghanistan diminishes and we try to create an Afghan army and police that will function in the future, that's going to cost an enormous amount of money. The sums that that will require in terms of foreign aid actually dwarf the entire Afghan government budget. And that seems to be a kind of dependency in the future that one might be wary of.
In other words, we're going to have to pay for it or there won't be
– There are not economic resources within Afghanistan to support the kind of – the size of the army that we hope will – the Afghans will have on their own. Now, something Barfield shows is that this kind of predicament is not completely unprecedented. In the 19th century, you had Afghan leaders who spoke in highly xenophobic terms about the British and other outsiders and created a sort of Afghan national identity in opposition to Westerners often. And yet those same rulers are often supported by fairly generous British subsidies. really would not have been able to rule without that money. If they hadn't had the British subsidies, they would have had to have taxed their own people, and that could have actually led to revolts against them. So there's a very tenuous kind of deal that, you know, I will take the British money, I will not attack the British on the frontier with India, but I will also maintain my popularity through attacking the British.
And this sounds like the kind of problem we face today, right?
Yes. If you listen to Karzai, who often goes back and forth very rapidly between speaking in quite hostile terms about Americans and other foreigners in Afghanistan and at the same time speaking quite forthrightly about the need for them to continue to be there and offer support, it's quite reminiscent.
Okay, now we get to the third book. It's called Can Intervention Work? It's by Rory Stewart, an author who will be familiar to some of our listeners, and Gerald Canals. I hope I've pronounced that right. Well, do they think it can work?
They don't say it can never work, but I wouldn't think anyone would call them optimists. The book is a curious book. It's actually the first of a series that W.W. Norton is publishing in conjunction with Amnesty International, and it's going to look at a range of different issues related broadly to human rights. And Rory Stewart himself, in addition to being a Conservative Party member of Parliament in England, an adventurer and travel writer.
A very good travel writer.
Very good one. And an administrator of provinces in Iraq and the creator of an NGO for preservation in Kabul. In addition to all these other things, he was also the director of the Human Rights Center at Harvard until recently. So he brings a lot to this book, which he's co-written with a colleague of his who was also at Harvard. It's a curious book. One half of it is an essay about Bosnia by Gerald Canals. One half of it is an essay about Afghanistan by Rory Stewart. Mm. They're more or less compatible, but Canals defends the intervention in Bosnia and says very much that it did work in his view, not simply in ending violence, but in creating some kind of workable political arrangement in that country. But he also insists that it's one thing to try to reach a peace arrangement and then bring outsiders in to enforce it. That's something that can work in his view. What is very difficult, he says, is to do nation building under fire. You can end a war or you can build a state. It's very hard to do both at the
same
time.
Yeah.
And in many ways, though he doesn't spell this out, you can see that as a critique of the counterinsurgency strategy that the American military has practiced in Iraq and Afghanistan. David Petraeus, Stanley McChrystal, all these people, important supporters of it. And advocates, you know, that is a strategy that says to end an insurgency, you need to protect the people who are living out in the provinces. And the best way to do that is to be connecting them to some sort of workable government that they feel loyal to. And that requires building up that government. It's a very difficult endeavor and one that Rory Stewart certainly thinks has been attempted in Afghanistan and very poorly and unsuccessfully.
So does he think it can be done better then? Is Stewart really writing a critique of how it's being done now and does he see a way to improve it?
He's not especially programmatic about what should be done. He does seem to imply gingerly that sending in more troops, as the Obama administration did in 2009 and 2010, you know, may have perverse consequences. It may create more instability rather than less as people respond to the intrusions of foreigners in their villages that they're not happy with, as new opportunities for corruption, new amounts of money come into the economy and distort people's incentives. All of these sorts of things just need to be taken into account. He's really not saying we should leave tomorrow or anything like that. He's just saying we need to be very modest in our goals, very quick to reconsider things that are not working. Also, he's somewhat uncomfortable, I think, with what he would probably call sort of moralism. I mean, just that something seems right doesn't mean you should do it if it can't be done. And just to be very clear about that is an important principle for him.
Thanks a lot, Alex.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Alexander Starr, whose essays, Applied Anthropology, appears in this week's book review. Gregory Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, on the nonfiction side of things, Bill Clinton hits number three in his first week with his book Back to Work, which is kind of a prescription for the economy, making the case for how Obama's been handling things and trying to sell it better than he feels Obama has been selling it. We also have Seal Target Geronimo by Chuck Ferrer, which is about the search for Osama bin Laden. And Robert Massey's book, Catherine the Great, is new at number nine on the list.
Right, reviewed on our cover by Catherine Harrison, a monumental book by a monumental historian.
That's right. Massey, of course, did Nicholas and Alexandra almost 30 years ago.
And that was an enormous bestseller. I think made into a film, too. How about fiction?
Well, Umberto Eco cracks the list at number 10 with his new novel, The Prague Cemetery, which is about the making of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a big conspiracy novel.
Now, is that a novel? Isn't it a nonfiction book, Protocols of Elders of
Protocols?
Zion?
It's a hoax.
It's a kind
forgery.
Of fantasy. Yeah.
Exactly. It's making the case that there's a big Jewish cabal kind of controlling all world events, hoping to take over the world at some point.
And enormously influential in its day. I mean, there were many people who took it seriously, and some still do.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Hitler was a big fan, for instance. It has fueled a lot of anti-Semitism in Europe and in America since it first came out in the early 20th century.
And what else is for fiction?
There's a new fantasy novel, The Alloy of Law. It's the second in a series by Brandon Sanderson. Topping the list is 11-22-63. That's Stephen King's new time travel novel about an English teacher who goes back to try to stop the JFK assassination.
Number one for Stephen King. Well, we've seen that before. In fact, he has quite an amazing track record.
It is really amazing, Sam. He first made the list with his second book, Salem's Lot, back in 1976. Later on, his first book, Carrie, also made the list once the movie came out, which means that going back 35 years, every single novel that he's written, that's almost 50 novels, has made the bestseller list.
And this one is a really ambitious book.
It really is. You know, it's the first time that he's written a historical novel, and you can feel him trying to find his way into it a little bit. He's never done history before, and so as he goes back to the late 50s and early 60s, you feel him doing his research a little bit. But once he settles into it and really gets into that world, he recreates it as well as he has in any of his books. He really gets a feel for the time and the place. And he's asking big questions about history, about any individual's ability to change the world, and asks what happens if some events go different. It's that same kind of alternate history that you've seen science fiction writers do forever, and even people like Philip Roth, more literary attempts.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.